You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman, we're here with you, and it's Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, Jumu'ah Mubarak, whatever it may be for you. Happy Friday, and of course, it being Friday, in the first hour of our program, that means it's time for our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator. Although the good citizens of Vermont, I was one for a decade, I know they're very proud that he's their senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's our brunch with Bernie hour. I'm curious what's on your mind about what's going on. We've had a lot since the last time we talked.
We did. Obviously, job numbers are important. Obviously, I think there's been a lot of discussion about the president's performance in the debate the other night and what that means. And there is, I think, increased discussion about how we go forward on deficit reduction. There have been some troubling articles that I've read which suggest that some in Washington are moving in the wrong direction. I think in terms of the debate, no question that in terms of performance, the president was not at his best. In terms of theater, I think it's fair to say that Romney won that debate. But I think in terms of substance, what is important for people to understand is that Romney displayed that etch-a-sketch characteristic, which I think he has been displaying almost throughout his whole political career, changing positions. And I think the president was a little bit surprised to find that virtually everything this guy's been saying for the last 18 months was gone, and suddenly he was no longer a right-wing conservative but a moderate who was worried about children and worried about teachers and worried about people who might need health care if they had pre-existing conditions. And all of this stuff is simply stuff that he pulled out of his hat for this debate. And I think that took the president a little bit aback. But the reality is that right now, in terms of substance, in terms of where Mr. Romney is at the head of a right-wing extremist party, that's not what the Republican Party has always been, that is where they are today. You have a party which absolutely, positively wants and will, if given the power to do so, give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country at a time when the rich are already doing phenomenally well. These people will, if given the opportunity to do it, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut education, and move this country along the oligarchic path of a handful of very, very wealthy people owning and controlling our economic and political life. What I was disappointed about in the debate was that the president really did not take Mr. Romney on forcefully in terms of defending some of the very positive accomplishments of his administration, pointing out that it is nothing to be ashamed about, that 30 million more Americans will get health insurance as a result of the Affordable Care Act, making everyone understand that despite Romney's rhetoric, pre-existing conditions will not be available to the vast majority of the people who will need them if Romney is reelected, making it clear that as difficult as the economy is right now, that the worst thing we can do is go back to the old ideology that Bush gave us for 8 years, more tax breaks for the rich, more deregulation of Wall Street, more unfettered free trade, which has led us to where we are today. So, Tom, I think I was not happy with the president's performance, but I think we've got a month to make it clear to every American what a disaster a Romney victory would be and what a disaster it would be if the Republicans regained control of the United States Senate. That's, you know, probably the issue I think that most people are thinking about now.
If I could put a punctuation point on that, have you, I'm guessing you haven't because I think this just came out, the comments that Antonin Scalia made at the American Enterprise Institute either last night or this morning?
Nope, didn't see that. I've been on the road all day.
It's just four sentences. Let me share it with you. It was a question and answer, or a few sentences. It's a paragraph. He says the death. They were asked about, you know, how would he decide? What did he think? You know, he says the death penalty. Give me a break. It's easy. Abortion, absolutely easy. Nobody ever thought the Constitution prevented laws against or restrictions on abortion. Homosexual sodomy. Come on. For 200 years, it was criminal in every state. The Constitution means exactly what I think it ought to mean. End of quote. Verbatim.
Well, that's a very enlightened statement in a democratic society, that the Constitution means what Justice Scalia thinks he means. I would remind my friends in Massachusetts that Scott Brown, I think, suggested, if my memory is correct, that Scalia was his favorite justice.
Yes, his model judge.
Yeah, his model judge. So I hope the folks in Massachusetts understand that. Look, we have a situation right now where, as a result of Citizens United, as a result of the fact that we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and the worst that it's been in this country since the 1920s, you got, Tom, and this is really scary stuff, and the American people have got to rise up and take it on. You have a small number of folks, a handful of very wealthy and powerful billionaires who are in the process of trying to buy the United States government. Citizens United has given them that opportunity. The Koch brothers, as I've mentioned many times, spending $400 million on this campaign. Mr. Sheldon Adelson is going to spend $100 million. We got other zillionaires spending all kinds of money. And they want to take us into a place where we push back and rescind virtually every major piece of legislation passed in the last 80 years since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which was designed to protect working families and the middle class. These guys want to eventually move to the privatization of Social Security, give it over to Wall Street. There are some of these guys, right-wing Republicans, who believe that Social Security is unconstitutional. Government shouldn't be involved in protecting the retirement security of elderly people or people with disabilities. There are folks there, Paul Ryan, the Romney's vice presidential nominee, has come up with a plan to end Medicare as we know it in 10 years and give a voucher to seniors, which will be totally inadequate in making in providing the health care that sick elderly seniors need. At a time when we have tens and tens of millions of people with no health insurance, they want to make drastic cuts in Medicaid, throwing millions of kids off of health insurance, making it harder for middle-class families to be able to provide for their parents who need nursing home care. At a time when college education is increasingly unaffordable and we need to expand the Pell program and other federal programs to make it easier for working-class families to send their kids to college. These guys want to make drastic cuts in those programs. They want to cut back on nutrition. And I think if people think, well, you know, he's exaggerating, I really am not. What you have right now is a right-wing extremist party who believes that the function of government primarily is defense. And despite the fact that we have tripled defense spending since 1997, spending over $700 billion a year now, they want to spend more on defense, want to give more tax breaks to the rich, and they want to cut back on almost everything else that you can think of. And in terms of environmental issues like global warming, it ain't on their radar screen. Never comes up. Not to be discussed. Every scientist, or virtually all scientists, know how serious this problem is. We have Republicans who refuse to even acknowledge the reality of global warming.
Excellent point. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls next on our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, sanders.senate.gov, ours, tomhartman.com. Our telephone number, 866-987-THOM. We'll be back with your calls for Senator Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can also drop by our live chat room. It's free. Go over to tomhartman.com, hang out with some of the finest minds in the world. Say hello.
And for a multitude of things like them, we have only just begun to fight.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your calls in our national town hall meeting. And both our chat room and Orlando had this question, Bernie. What do we do about Republican voter disenfranchisement from the voter suppression ID laws to, you know, is this
well, what Orlando is saying is that he is, you know, disgusted with a situation where Republicans continue to fight extremely unfairly. Look, you know, everybody has a different point of view in this world, and by living in a democratic society, we say, okay, that's your point of view, this is my point of view. We're going to hold an election, and we see who wins. But what Republicans have done in the last several years is, number one, pushed very, very hard. Mitch McConnell was the Republican leader in the Senate, very much part of the process of getting Citizens United passed by Mr. Scalia and the United States Supreme Court. And that opened the door to huge amounts of money into the political process, not all of it, but the vast majority of it going to Republicans and often to right-wing Republicans. Second of all, and this is Orlando's point, at a time when voter fraud in America is not, fortunately, thank God, a serious problem under the guise of combating a non-serious problem, what Republican governors and legislatures have done all over this country is to pass laws making it difficult for lower-income people and seniors to participate in the political process. And the reason they did that is very, very clear to everybody, as Orlando just said. It is to lower voter turnout for those people who will vote against Republicans. That's all, pure and simple. Everybody understands that. So if you're poor and you don't own a car and you don't drive and you don't have a photo ID license, driver's license, you know what? It's going to be harder to get you to the polling place. And that is exactly the intention of these laws. Now, the good news is that in recent months, in a number of states, most recently in Pennsylvania, these laws, appropriately enough, have begun to be stricken down by the courts because they're clearly unconstitutional. They are clearly an effort to deny people their constitutional right to participate in the democratic political process, to vote. So Orlando was right. I mean, these guys have billionaires behind them funding their campaigns. They want to make it harder for working people and lower-income people to vote. And we've just got to stand up and fight as hard as we can to defeat them and that entire process.
Okay, Greg, in Parlin, New Jersey, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Just let me start by saying Oliver Wendell Holmes said that taxes are the admission to a civil society. Now, my question, Senator Sanders, is anybody in Washington talking about, to solve our revenue problem, ending our free trade policy and putting high tariffs on all imports and getting out of the WTO, creating a demand in the USA that would start putting our 24 million hardworking Americans who lost their jobs because they were outsourced back to work, paying their fair taxes, revenue, and stimulating our economy by once again being able to purchase durable goods labeled made in the USA? And that's my question.
Well, it's a great question, Craig, and the answer is yes. You're talking to somebody who has voted against every one of these disastrous trade agreements. So let me just take a moment on it, because it is an issue, Craig, that is not talked about terribly much. I'll tell you why. Because essentially you have virtually all Republicans who agree with unfettered free trade. You have many Democrats who agree with unfettered free trade. You have almost every major editorial page in the United States of America that agrees with unfettered free trade, despite the fact that tens of thousands of factories have been shut down in recent years. We've lost 55,000 factories in the last 10 years. Many of them, not all, but many of them due to these disastrous trade agreements, which, as Craig suggested, companies are shutting down here, moving to China, moving to Vietnam, moving to other low-wage countries, and they bring their products back into this country. So Craig is asking an important question that does not get discussed enough. Tom and I talk about it quite a bit. But Craig, yes, you are absolutely correct. We need to understand that NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, has failed. It has been good for corporate America, for the big money interest, but has been bad for working people. We have lost millions of decent paying jobs. And what is the answer? The answer is, among other, in addition to changing our trade policy, is to make it clear to large corporations that they've got to start rebuilding the manufacturing sector in this country and start producing products here made in the USA. And is our tariffs part of that solution? Absolutely they are. Craig, thanks very much for that good question.
Okay. And Jerry in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on KGNF. Jerry, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. We have just a minute to break.
I had a question for the senator. Does he think it would be a good idea to start like a secondary voluntary retirement program that would be for like stocks or government bonds that would sort of blunt the Romneys of the world from trying to turn Social Security into an investment vehicle?
Well, I think, Jerry, that what we have to understand is Social Security. You know, I hear some of my conservative friends say, well, you know, if you invest in Wall Street in the stock market, you're going to make more money than you would through Social Security. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes it is absolutely not true. And talk to the millions of people who lost their life savings when Wall Street collapsed in 2008. Social Security is not an investment program. You want to invest? Invest in Wall Street. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. That's your right. Social Security is an insurance program, which has worked magnificently for 77 years, never once failing to pay out what people are entitled to.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us here on our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. Your opportunity to ask your question of Senator Bernie Sanders. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov, ours at tomhartman.com. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can check out our Tom Hartman iPhone and iPad app over at the App Store or at tomhartman.com. The place where smart people get their news is the Tom Hartman Program. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Bernie, were you going to pick up an answer on the other side of this break?
No, I think we're okay.
Okay, great. Let's see here. Woody in Litchfield, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning or good afternoon. Again, it's a pleasure to speak with you guys, and I know I've given you some tough ones in the past. And I guess today I want to focus on getting a Congress we can work with. I've got 34 years with USDA in the lending side, Farmers Home Administration, Rural Development, and the Farm Service Agency. An example of Congress's act is that we have a guarantee program that I don't have the authority to review the appraisal. Solyndra was a guarantee loan that was passed by a Republican Congress under the 2002 Farm Bill. The ability to make these loans, I think, needs to be preserved, but just not guaranteed. Let's use federal dollars and have federal employee service loans. My daughter had a student loan, and when I called on her behalf to try to get something solved, I was talking to a loan servicer out of the Philippines because it was a guarantee loan.
Yeah.
How do we get those loans made by the government and then serviced by government employees that can then act on the behalf of the administration?
In other words, stop outsourcing, stop having banks be middlemen in these loans, I think was the question.
Right. I think Woody, as Tom and I have talked about many times, in terms of loans and in terms of banking, I think I speak for you, Tom, when you say you want to go back to the old boring banking system, right?
Yes. Safe, predictable, boring, mildly profitable banks.
Right. In other words, I mean, banking ain't hard. What we have now on Wall Street, which has got to be addressed if we're going to save this economy and save the middle class, is Wall Street has been converted from a banking system into a gambling casino. And what they are involved with is not lending money to the productive economy where businesses can gain affordable loans and create jobs in the manufacturing sector or the service sector or whatever. But basically, Wall Street has become an island unto itself where its own its main function is to make money for itself within its own world. And the result of that is that all over this country, we have businesses who desperately need affordable loans so they can expand and create jobs. They can't get it, which leads me back to a position I have long advocated and introduced legislation to deal with, and that is the need to break up these huge financial institutions, six of which have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America. Yeah, to Woody's point, I think the answer is if you're going to lend money, you got to know who your client is. Excuse me. You have to know whether that person is able to pay back that loan, especially if that loan is guaranteed. I don't think that's very complicated.
Okay. Marcia in Raleigh, North Carolina, listening on the TuneIn app. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. You have a lot of people calling you saying, Mr. Sanders, what can we do to solve the voter suppression? What can we do to get people to stop voting against their own best interests? And I want them to know that the Democrats also are not supporting their best interests. They didn't know that they wanted to support gay rights till a week ago. They don't know where the God is supposed to be in a platform or in church. They don't support single payer. And there's a lot of other things. So my question, you suggested the day after the election, we join a progressive party. I'm inviting you to join the Green Party, you, Tom Hartman, Elizabeth Warren, and all the other progressives, and bring your celebrity friends with you. What say you?
Well, Marsha, I didn't say that. What I said is that the day after the election, we have got to organize a strong grassroots movement all over this country to make sure that the president stands up for working families and remembers why he was elected in the first place. That is what I said. As the longest-serving independent in the history of the U.S. Congress, somebody who's not a Democrat, and not a Republican, I am not unsympathetic, you know, to the efforts of third parties, including the Green Party. There are a lot of great people doing a lot of good work. But right now, my main emphasis is to make sure that we defeat a right-wing extremist party, which is the Republican Party, and to make sure that Obama stands up for working families. We just talked about trade policy. We have talked about the need for a massive jobs program to put millions of people to work. We have talked about the need for real health care reform, and I hope my state leads the nation in terms of a single-payer system. Talked about the need to finally take on Wall Street and start breaking up these banks. Now, I think third parties can play a great role. Where there are areas where third parties can work, and in the state of Vermont, we probably have the most successful third party. In America, we have, I think, about six people in our legislature out of 150 in the House who are members of the Progressive Party. It is likely that after November 6th, we'll have 3 out of 30 people in the Senate who are members of the Progressive Party. They are working closely with progressive Democrats to bring about some really good things within the state of Vermont. So what I said was we have to put as much pressure on Obama as we possibly can through a strong grassroots movement. If there are areas of the state where people want to go third party, that is absolutely their right.
Jason in Hollywood, Florida, listening on Sirius XM. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jason? No, Jason. Okay. Stu in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Bernie. Thanks both for all that you do and seeing this thing through over the next 4 weeks. Hey, how can we change the president's mindset in terms of a balance, a truly balanced approach towards a deficit, cutting the deficit? The other day during the debate, one of the things I wasn't too happy with the president, he says, well, we are following a balanced approach of $2.5 in cuts to every dollar in revenue enhancement. That's not balanced. Balanced is $1 to $1. And we need to make everybody, President on down, understand that entitlements are there because people are entitled to them. Social Security, Medicare, things that people pay taxes for. There's a social contract in this country, and I'm 49 years old. I want to make sure it's going to be there whenever I get there. So how can we change the president?
Okay, I'll tell you how. All right, Stu, you've asked a great question, and I want to tell you this is an issue that I've been working on really hard. What I was upset about is not only the ratio of cuts to revenue that the president is talking about. That's only half the story, Stu. When you're talking about revenue, where is that revenue coming from? A lot of people are assuming, oh, well, that's going to be tax increases on millionaires and billionaires. Not really. Doesn't have to be. Revenue can come from the middle class as well. The other thing that was very disturbing to me, in addition to that statement on the part of the president, was his comments on Social Security. When he began the debate I think the first question that Jim Lehrer asked was on Social Security and Medicare, and he said, well, I think basically Governor Romney and I look at the Social Security problem similarly. We're coming from a similar place. That is not a good answer, because the fact is, and I try to make this point as often as I can, Social Security has nothing to do with deficit reduction, because Social Security hasn't contributed a nickel to the deficit. The fact that it has a $2.7 trillion surplus and can pay out all benefits for the next 21 years. The only reason Social Security is being brought into this discussion is that Republicans forever, from the day after Social Security was passed, wanted to kill it, and they're still at it. And it disturbs me very much that Democrats are falling into that trap. I authored a letter along with Harry Reid, the majority leader, which now has 29 signatures on it, all of Democrats, saying, hey, Social Security should not be part of deficit reduction. Social Security is independently funded by the payroll tax. Now, to go a step further, Stu, the issue here is how, after the election, assuming Obama wins, and assuming the Democrats control the Senate and hopefully gain some seats in the House, maybe take over the House, how do we go forward with deficit reduction? What I fear very much is that Democrats, and there are meetings taking place right now, gang of eight, meeting with CEOs, meeting with Simpson and Bowles, and what I fear, and will do my best to defeat, is some kind of $4 trillion grand deal, which would, in fact, cut Social Security, which would cut Medicare not the way the Republicans want, but make cuts nonetheless, which could cut Medicaid and other programs. And the deficit contribution would be much less than it should be, given the fact that today we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. Wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well. Top 1% owns 42% of the wealth in America. Bottom 60% owns 2.3%. When you have that dynamics of a few people with incredible wealth doing extraordinarily well, paying the lowest effective tax rate in decades, you know what? It's kind of a no-brainer. If we're going to do deficit reduction, those guys are going to have to pay more in taxes. End of discussion. And it's not just not extending Bush's tax breaks for the top 2%. You got corporations out there doing phenomenally well. Some cases, record-breaking profits. One quarter of corporations don't pay a nickel in taxes. We're losing $100 billion a year because these corporations and wealthy individuals stashing their money in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Panama, other tax havens. You know what? You got to end that. Military spending, much too high. So there are things we can do to go to deficit reduction, but do it not on the backs of working families, elderly, children, and the lowest income people in this country.
It's our national town hall meeting, your opportunity to talk with Senator Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out Bernie's website at Sanders.Senate.gov. And, of course, TomHartman.com. Drop into our live chat room. All kinds of cool stuff there. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's our time for our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Just a quick heads up, a little later on in the program, Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General for the State of New York, is going to be with us. We're going to have one of our Taking Our Country Back candidates, a Democrat running for the U.S. Congress in Virginia's 9th District, will be with us, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz is going to drop by. Back with our questions for Senator Sanders. Tom in Tallahassee, Florida, you're on the air with Bernie.
Senator, I was just listening a little bit there, and I think we're missing the boat a little bit. We've always had lobbyists. We've always had interest groups trying to influence, you know, the Congress and the agenda. I think the problem is right now, honestly, because leadership. One thing I heard at the debates the other night that I liked is governor of Massachusetts. Every Monday morning, he had a meeting with the leaders of both sides. They discussed issues. They tried to find common ground. And President Obama has made absolutely zero attempt to do that in the last 3.5 years. And I think what we have now is a Congress with the lowest approval ratings we've ever had in the history of the Congress. And that's why we've had no leadership. And meeting, talking, and trying to find common ground and not trying to place blame on lobbyists and interest groups we bought.
Tom, you're breaking up really badly, but and speaking of blame, Tom seems to be blaming the president for all this.
Yeah, I think we got the thrust of Tom's remark. And Tom, what I want to just tell you, because I'm kind of down there, you know, it just ain't true. If there's a criticism to be made of the president, is that time and time and time again, and you saw it in the debate, he has reached out and tried to get some agreement. I think the more honest analysis and conclusion is to hear what Mitch McConnell said several years ago when he made it very clear. What is, you know, he was asked, as I recall, Senator McConnell, what is, and McConnell is the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, what is your major goal?
Here is in his own words, Bernie, if you'd like.
Okay.
Here it is.
Sure, please.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
There you go.
All right. And what I got to tell you, Tom, that's just not rhetoric. You know, again, I know, you know, everybody has their political beliefs. Some will believe me, some will not. But you have to be down there on the floor to see how much obstruction takes place, how many filibusters are taking place, how hard it is to get the simplest thing done. Do you think these guys want to create jobs in America if that makes Obama look good? They don't. They don't. So what you're dealing with, Tom, I have, believe me, been very critical of the president in a number of ways. Nobody in the Democratic caucus more critical of him than I. But on the other hand, on this one, you have to appreciate that he is now dealing with a right-wing extremist party that has a view way out of step with the vast majority of the American people, which is why Mitt Romney is in the process of doing his etch-a-sketch and changing his views a month before the election. And these guys have tried to do everything they can to make Obama an unsuccessful president. So I don't think it is fair to place that onus on the president.
Mike, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Great show. Glad you're doing this. My question is there something Obama could do, like an executive order, for our crumbling bridges, the roads, put a bunch of people to work doing stuff like that, paying taxes? There's so much whining back and forth
about
the deficit,
Mike,
budget. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you asked me that question, because early this morning I drove down to Brattleboro, Vermont, in the southern part of the state, and we had a ceremony with Ray LaHood, who is the Secretary of Transportation, to announce the completion, a wonderful completion of a great project in Vermont. It was it was improving our rail bed so that trains are now going to go 20 miles an hour faster. We're cutting a half hour off of the time that it took to get from one end of our state to the other. It was a $52 million stimulus package bill. And that is exactly what we have to do all over this country, not just in rail, but in roads, but in bridges, but in wastewater plants, and in schools, and in airports. We do have a crumbling infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers said we need to spend $2.2 trillion over a five-year period just to get a passing grade. And that is the fastest way. Tom is exactly right. You want to put, Mike is exactly right. If you want to put people to work, invest in infrastructure, that is something that we're trying to do. The president is supportive of that effort. We're running into strong opposition from our Republican colleagues.
Bernie, we have about a minute and a half left. I'm just curious if you could comment on the difference between investing and spending. Republicans seem to have totally blurred the line between the two.
Absolutely. When you are investing, as any corporation will tell you, corporations, for example, invest huge amounts of money in advertising. Well, why do they do that? Because they end up getting more people to purchase their products. That's called an investment for them to make money. within the government sector, within the civil society, it makes sense, for example, to invest in our schools so that we well educate our kids well. They are able to go out and get good jobs and be productive taxpaying members of society. That is called an investment. Mike just talked about infrastructure. You don't have to be a genius to figure out it does not make sense and it is not good for the country if your bridges are falling down, if your roads are undrivable, if your rail is slower than the rest of the world, and if your wastewater plants and water systems aren't working. When you invest in those areas, A, you create jobs, B, you make the future of our country more productive, and C, we become more competitive as a nation. That's what an investment is about. Now, if you want to go out and buy some fancy gift tomorrow, you know, that's fine that you don't need. I guess you're spending money. But investing is improving the future of our nation. If you're a private sector guy, it's improving your profit margin, I guess, for your company. But it has a goal in mind.
Thank you so much. And Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today and all these weeks, all these years. And we look forward to seeing you actually the week after next. I'll be off next Friday.
Okay, so, great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you so much, Bernie. We'll be back with Debbie Wasserman Schultz here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, cable systems nationwide. Welcome back to our program. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz is with us. She is the chairperson of the Democratic National Committee, and as well as the congresswoman representing the 20th District of Florida. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. BarackObama.com, of course, the main website for the work that you're doing in addition to being a member of the House of Representatives.
Yes, and also gotavote.com, because we have early voting going on in lots of different places and voter registration deadlines coming up. Gotaregister.com is another website that people can get information on where and how they can get registered.
Great, and GOTTA is G-O-T-T-A, gotavote.com, gotaregister.com. So how's it going?
Well, you know, it's going well. We're focused on continuing to stand up the most dynamic, most significant, largest grassroots presidential campaign in history, while the Romney campaign has got a handful of billionaires trying to buy him the White House. And, you know, we're excited about the job numbers that came out today. We know we have work left to do, but to have a 44-month low in the unemployment rate and in the last year, a 2% drop in the unemployment rate, which is the biggest single drop since 1995, we're making progress, but we've 31 straight months of job growth in the private sector, but we need to continue to move our economy forward and rebuild it from the middle class out, as President Obama's been fighting for.
Yeah, indeed. I'm curious. I'm guessing that you've engaged in debates before, as you know, to become a member of Congress.
Yeah.
How do you deal with a debate opponent who nakedly lies and in fact will concatenate several lies together in a single sentence, and then you're not even sure which one to go after? How does one deal with that?
Well, I think you have to, number one, in any debate, you want to make sure, as President Obama did the other night, that you make your case about what your plans are. And mm-hmm. he, I thought, laid out his plan to increase manufacturing jobs over the next 4 years by 1 million and cut oil imports in half. And then also, you know, hold Mitt Romney's feet to the fire. You know, when he tried to run away from the fact that he has a tax plan that would, you know, cut $5 trillion of taxes skewed towards the wealthy, the president kept coming back at him and you know, trying to make sure that that people understand that Mitt Romney was trying to be, you know, a completely different person than the candidate we've seen over the last year and a half. and we're going to continue to hold him accountable for, you know, this is Mitt Romney, you know, his campaign foreshadowed that this would be his etch-a-sketch moment, and it appears that that effort has begun, and we're not going to let them get away with it.
Well, in fact, one of his campaign surrogates on television this morning made the comment that Romney moving to the center, was his phrase, was simply a campaign tactic, that real conservatives know that it's just a campaign tactic to get middle-of-the-road voters in. Do you think that middle-of-the-road voters or undecided voters or whatever the correct phrase is, independent voters, that they're really that dumb?
I think that independent and moderate voters and women and Hispanics and seniors and young people, I think that the reason that Mitt Romney has his favorability numbers upside down is because he's shown the American people what he's made of and who he really is. I mean, someone who could so dismissively say that 47% of Americans don't matter and that they're victims and that they are dependent on government and don't take personal responsibility for their own lives, that's the real Mitt Romney. And, you know, if it were just that, you know, then maybe Mitt Romney would get away with saying that he made a terrible mistake and that he didn't mean it, except that he said that corporations were people, and he said that the way students should afford to go to college is to borrow money from their parents, and, you know, he tried to make a $10,000 bet on the debate stage during the primaries. So this is someone who really has demonstrated who he is, and if you remember the poet Maya Angelou said, if people show you who they are, you should believe them. Mm-hmm. I think who Mitt Romney is, Americans have consistently seen, and he's going to do his best to try to etch-a-sketch that away, but we're not going to let him get away with it. We're going to continue to talk about the work that President Obama's been able to do and how he's brought us from the worst economic crisis that we've faced since the Great Depression to 31 straight months of job growth in the private sector, and, you know, we're going to keep pressing forward.
We're talking with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. You have been on a bus tour through Ohio,
yes,
if I have this right. What have you been seeing? What are you hearing from people? What's your sense of what's going on in the Midwest?
Well, folks in the Midwest, particularly here in Ohio, they're enjoying, you know, an even greater drop in their unemployment rate. They have significantly benefited from President Obama's courageous move to rescue the American automobile industry when Mitt Romney would have let Detroit go bankrupt. And he's got like 1 in 8 jobs here in Ohio, 850,000 jobs tied to the American automobile industry. 80 of 88 counties here in Ohio have an auto manufacturing facility. So they understand how important making sure that we had a thriving auto industry in the United States was. And so they've continued to be supportive of President Obama, and they understand that, you know, this is a president like his decision to crack down on China's dumping of tires and adding a tariff, and that's allowed in Youngstown, Ohio, a $1 billion steel plant to be built. First steel plant that we've had built, really in recent times, created jobs and good paying jobs that are going to continue to help our manufacturing sector have the surge that it's enjoyed for the first time since the 1990s.
Yeah, very, very well said. Congresswoman, thank you so much for being with us today and for the great work you're doing as the chairperson of the DNC.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's much appreciated. Thank you. And keep it up.
Bye.
So, Anything Goes Friday here. Your calls. David, listening on AM 950 in St. Paul, Minnesota. David, what's on your mind today?
Yeah. Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wanting to compare and contrast, you know, we have all these state legislators passing these voter suppression laws and ID laws and everything. And I'd like to compare and contrast what happened with this Republican group as far as voting fraud, being committed by this corporation, submitting all these false names and everything in Florida, and compare and contrast what happened to Acorn. You know, Acorn was defunded. They were thrown under the bus and pretty much dismantled, whereas this corporation, I don't know if anyone's going to be held accountable for, you know, these people should be thrown in prison for submitting these false names and everything that they have.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that Acorn was actually reporting voter fraud or attempts at voter fraud or election fraud when they caught it being done, where the exact opposite of this company, this Republican company that was actually doing it. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. JJ in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, JJ, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yes, Tom. This is regarding program trading on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in realization of some of these brokerage houses have and banks can program trade as much as 10,000 times per hour on one equity. You know, in and out of an equity, trying
right.
to reach
70% of the total volume of the New York Stock Exchange right now.
Yes, and my idea here would be to impose 1 cent per share taxation on each trade. You know, per
yep.
share. That would one person got to buy, one got to sell, so that would be 2 cents per share. And I think we could really reduce our federal budget this way and get some of the, you know, it isn't the little guy. A day trader, if he trades 10,000 times a year, it's $100 on him.
Mm-hmm.
But these, like, really big powerhouse brokerage things, I don't want to name names, but they could be really billions per day.
Yes.
And this could help our debt, and this would get probably some of the money out of the hands of these greedy corporate types that are really not, they're really not helping.
No, I'm totally with you, JJ. And it would also... It would also make the stock market more reflective of actual investors rather than just robots. We need to go back to the tax we had from 35 to 64.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It was called at that time, by the way, the STET tax, the Security Transaction Exchange Tax, or excise tax, excuse me. And we really do need to revisit that.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her.
We are taking our country back one congressional district at a time, and with us today is a candidate for the 9th District of Virginia, a family farmer and candidate for U.S. Congress, Anthony Flaccavento, and his website is a49.com. That's the letter A, F-O-R, the digit 9, number 9.com, as in the 9th District of Virginia. And Anthony, welcome to the program.
Oh, so glad to be on, Tom. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And hopefully a lot of people will go for A, as in Anthony, A49, 9 as in 9th District, digit 9.com, and check out your website. Tell us what your, first of all, who you're running against, why you're running, and what your campaign is. Give us the elevator speech here.
Sure. The quick summary of it. Yes, I'm running against a one-term Tea Party Republican by the name of Morgan Griffith. One really not on his merits in 2010, but on a campaign that simply attacked the president and the former Democratic incumbent Rick Boucher, and he was one of the founders of the so-called War on Coal that is gets a lot of good airtime for right-wing Republicans. I'm running because I'm pretty much the opposite of this fellow. I've not been in politics at all up to this point, but what I have been doing is working to build a more sustainable economy and stronger communities in central Appalachia, in the 9th District of Virginia, and in a lot of neighboring places. I've worked in Tennessee and West Virginia, Kentucky, and other states. And my experience is essentially working in what you might call limited resource areas, but working with folks like tobacco farmers and loggers and coal miners and small business owners, many of whom are Republican-leaning, to work together to create more environmentally friendly ways of doing business, of jobs, to actually improve their finances, their economics, their market share, and to do all that in a way that we invest in community. I'm a huge believer in the idea of building community capital by investing in everything from farmers markets to food aggregation centers for organic produce to broadband infrastructure to help connect folks to the broader world. So we've been on that path for about 27 years and have had a lot of really exciting results in small towns and rural places that people just did not think would embrace organic farming or sustainable forestry and wood products or kind of arts and culture-based economy. All of that is now emerging very strongly throughout our region. And I'm running for Congress to say, you know what, this trickle-down nonsense that has been extracting wealth, I call it a suck-up economy. It's been sucking wealth up out of ordinary people and homeowners and small business and family farmers for years, that it's killing us. And the truth is we have a wonderful alternative, sustainable development or bottom-up economics, and that's what I'm running for.
Okay. And you said you've been working with these people doing what?
Well, for instance, when we started into the food sector, this part of the world, it's a mountainous region with a lot of rolling hills and little bits of flat land, and so most farming historically has been based on a few livestock, and then tobacco was the main cash crop and did pretty well for folks for a number of years. We started working with tobacco farmers, not to try to shut them down, but to say, let's see if we can't find better alternatives. And over a period of a few years, steered now well over 100, probably a couple hundred tobacco farmers to certified organic produce, to other kinds of produce, to free-range eggs, to grass-finished meats, all sort of very healthy foods. Mm-hmm. We built the local markets from farmers markets to this aggregation center that connected these farmers to local supermarkets, local colleges and universities, and created out of what was a declining tobacco economy, and tobacco is not a particularly good crop for people or the environment, instead now have a lot of farmers raising things that are really good for people that are being sold to their friends and neighbors and folks in nearby, and following environmental practices that are improving soil and water. So it's one example of this idea of, instead of saying we have to choose between jobs or the environment, we have to choose between clean air, clean water, or companies, we've begun to demonstrate that in almost every respect, if you look for the opportunities and work with local people, you can actually come up with solutions that are better for people, create more jobs, build community capital, and respect the environment. That's kind of the gist of it.
That's great. And you said we a couple of times. Did you mean as the kind of polite way of saying I, or is there an organization that you've been working with?
Yes. No. So I've done a number of different things, but the we refers to an organization I started in 1995, and before that I was working in other organizations, but that's been probably the most important one, called Appalachian Sustainable Development, or mm-hmm. ASD for short. It was one of the, I think, pioneering organizations, not just in Appalachia, but in the country, to try to grapple with this idea of sustainable development. It's a nonprofit, but at the same time a very entrepreneurial nonprofit. And a lot of those projects, also one creating sustainably harvested and locally manufactured flooring, and several others, came out of ASD. In 2009, we changed, and I became a private consultant so that I could take this same basic approach beyond Southwest Virginia, and have been working with communities as far away as New Mexico and the Arkansas Delta and Iowa, Nebraska. So, but the same idea of building community capital, taking what people have and their strengths and figuring out a way to work within the ecosystem. So I've done it as a nonprofit, kind of social entrepreneur, people might call that, as well as a farmer myself, an organic farmer, and now a small business owner as well.
Wow. We are talking with Anthony Flaccavento. A49.com is his website. A as in Anthony, 9 as in the digit 9, because he's running for the 9th District of Virginia. A4digit9.com is the website. Check it. You're the genuine article. I'm really impressed. And
I appreciate that.
Great work.
You know, one of the things too your listeners might appreciate is that although my platform is primarily about this idea of building healthy local food systems and a strong and diverse bottom-up economy, of course I'm also very committed to the idea that there's a tremendous amount of room in our current tax system for higher taxes on the top earners, and particularly taxes on wealth. Right now we have a tax system that's so skewed against people earning income and towards people who make their living from already having wealth.
Oh, boy, we could talk about that for an hour. That's a great one. Anthony.
For hours, but
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anthony Flaccavento, check it out. A49, the letter A, F-O-R, digit 9.com. Anthony, good luck.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. And Denny, in
yes.
Felda, Florida. You are on the air, sir.
Ah, good. Hey, good to talk to you, Tom. you know how we were all brought up kind of like with baby formula in the two-party system, Democrat, Republican, then there was a branch off that went to the Tea Party. I'm looking for a whole group of us to branch off and start the 99 Party. What do you think?
I think that there should be a lot of space for third, fourth, fifth, sixth parties in American politics. The tragic reality is we have one of the oldest democracies in the modern democratic world. It's, 230 and change years old. And the consequence of that is that, we were one of the first starts, one of the first tries. And when James Madison, the father of the Constitution, he spent 5 years studying national constitutions before he chaired, or he didn't chair, but he kept the notes for the Constitutional Convention and ultimately, penned the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787. And when the Constitution was done and he read through this thing and they were taking it out to people trying to sell it, he had this horrible sudden realization that, with first past the post, winner take all elections, that meant that you could have 51% of the people win the vote and 49% of the people lose the vote and just have no voice whatsoever, which basically meant that you were going to have a two-party system, or that if at that time there were no political parties. If political parties emerged, if you had three parties, you could have somebody with 36% of the vote, or 34% of the vote could rule. And if you had four parties, you could have somebody with 26% of the vote. If you had five parties, somebody with 21% of the vote. And that would not be small D democratic. That could be just, chaos. And he didn't know how to solve the problem. This was 1787. It wasn't until 1861 that John Stuart Mill came along and wrote On Liberty and his other books, in which he proposed proportional representation, where, the party that gets 4% of the vote gets 4% of the seats in Congress. That's how most of the world does their democracies, all but seven countries. All the other, there's about 100 democracies. All the rest of them do it that way. But that idea didn't even come along until we were in our Civil War. So back when the Constitution was written, the only thing Madison could come up with, and you can read this in Federalist Number 10, is Madison literally begging Americans not to form what he called factions, which today we call political parties. Please don't form political parties. Well, good luck on that. Madison ended up being the number two guy in the Democratic Republican Party, today known as the Democratic Party, just, 10 years later. Him and Jefferson basically started the thing because they had to have something to push back against the Federalists. But we are stuck with this two-party system, and the only two ways out of it are to, at the state-by-state level, go to something like proportional representation, and that can be done, and it doesn't require amending the Constitution, although it's going to, number one, actually, I'll get to the although it's going to in just a second. That's one way to do it. The other way is instant runoff voting, IRV, what you have in San Francisco, what you have in communities all across the country that the Green Party has been, pushing aggressively for decades. And these open up the political system. The problem is both parties are opposed to either of those because it would break their monopoly on political power in the United States. So, we the people have to, on the one hand, I think, get, as you mentioned, the Tea Party, Denny. The Tea Party, was funded by billionaires, but a lot of average people showed up, and they basically took over the Republican Party. We need to show up and take over the Democratic Party, and then once good progressives in charge of the Democratic Party say, really we should open this thing up even farther. Let's make the entire political system more progressive. Let's move to instant runoff voting or proportional representation all across the United States and make it so that, like the rest of the advanced democracies in the world, we can have these debates. So, Denny, thank you for raising that topic. I think it's a great one. And very well said. Kathleen in Highland Village, Texas. Hey, Kathleen, welcome to the program.
Are you there?
I am here. You are there.
Yes,
we are on the air.
I just want to make sure I was off the speakerphone. I just want to make one quick point because this has really irritated me for a long time, and my husband is a union worker. The banksters and the millionaires on Wall Street who cry that they're being vilified. We've been vilified for 30-plus years.
Oh,
I'm tired of it.
Wow. Union workers have not just been vilified for 30 years. 130 years ago, they were being murdered. They were being hung. They were being shot at. They were being burned out of their houses. Union workers have been, yes, absolutely. Well said, Kathleen. Thank you very much. Excellent point. Robert in Lawrence, South Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Yes, good afternoon. I got two quick comments and a question. Number one, you mentioned tobacco a while ago. I didn't think of it until I heard you talking about it. But anyhow, I made the comment about how many family members I'd lost due to tobacco in my local newspaper, in the opinions column, and they found a way to ridicule that.
Yeah, that's tragic. And, yeah.
Yes. Okay, the question I have for you is, can I email you on the question of slavery, and you get the paper, get the email?
Probably not. My personal email account is configured that, you know, it's like my personal email account. And, yeah. If you want to talk about politics, that's what I do for a living. That's what I do on the radio. Call the show. You're on right now. If you wanted to talk about it on the radio, we can talk about it.
Well,
or
I thought it would take us too much time, so I'll go ahead and my other comment if you
okay.
don't mind.
Sure. Or post a message on TomHartman.com. I very often see those. I do read the blog.
Okay. Here in South Carolina, so according to my opinion column in my paper, that a voter that a weapons permit is acceptable for a voter ID.
Right. It is in Texas, too.
All right. That's my comments for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Good to hear from you. Andrew in Westport, Connecticut. Hey, Andrew, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad you took my call because I really would like to hear your historical perspective on what's happening to our democracy in this country. We have 10 years of war, and nobody even talks about it.
Yep.
We have a Congress that's being preyed upon by lobbyists, over 12,000 at last estimate, and nothing's being done about that, and nothing's being done about political campaign finance. And it's open for grabs. Elections are open for grabs for anybody who has enough money.
Right.
There's no promise here that's going to change, and how is it going to affect our democracy? That's
well,
what I'm concerned about.
Here's my take on this. Your characterization is not inaccurate. We are in a very, very dire state, in large part because of people like Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's one of the reasons why I think this presidential election is so important, because the next president is almost certainly going to appoint at least two, probably three, and maybe four U.S. Supreme Court justices. And we know if it's Romney, there'll be more Scalias and Thomases and Roberts. And if it's Barack Obama, we'll have more Sotomayors and Kagans. So that's important. But the bigger picture here is that the United States has been here before. After Reconstruction, in the 1880s, 1890s, during that late part of the 19th century, there was this explosion of industrialization. A wealthy class emerged that the country had never seen before, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Carnegies, and so on, and the railroad barons, the Jay Goulds, the Sandersons, on the list goes. And in Montana, for example, Montana actually passed a law against this in 1909 as a consequence of this. There was a fellow, a wealthy guy who owned the copper mine, what became the Anaconda copper mine, who literally publicly said, and this was back when the state legislatures voted collectively for who they were going to send to the United States Senate. He said, anybody who will vote for me, I'll give them $10,000. My recollection, it was 10,000, might have been 1,000, but it was one or the other. And he literally stood on the floor of the House and Senate in Montana and passed out these, crisp $1,000 bills to these people. Montana was so horrified by that, they passed a law against it, which was just struck down by the Supreme Court. So we had this period in this 1880s, 1890s, where politics were just nakedly being bought. And then McKinley came along, and he had this guy, what was his last name? Anyhow, he had a guy, an advisor, who Karl Rove has identified as the fellow that he modeled himself after. And McKinley, got us into the Spanish-American War. And, along with one of the big newspapers, with William Randolph Hearst, and said to Frederick Remington, who was down in Cuba, get me the photos and I will give you, I'll help start the war. And he said that to McKinley. And so America had this horrible war. We had our politicians being bought off. We had a war against union workers. And what came out of all that was Teddy Roosevelt. What came out of that was a very strong progressive movement after 1901, when McKinley was assassinated. I'm not suggesting anybody should be, but McKinley went away. His vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, became president. And it turned out Republican Teddy Roosevelt was actually a progressive. And he started fighting back against these people. He started busting up the trusts. And that set the stage. Now, we did have another regressive period from 1920 to 29, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. A brief period where they, you know, we swung back toward the, in the Republican direction. But basically, that set the stage for the New Deal in 1935. So I think that the excesses that we're seeing right now with regard to campaign finances, with regard to wars, with regard to all these things that you've identified are setting the stage for a progressive rebellion, basically, a progressive backlash, a populist one at that. I'm actually very optimistic about the future of this country because we go in these cycles, and I think that we're on the cusp of another one right now. So, Andrew, I don't have an easy answer other than we all need to get involved and go to movetoamend.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
At movetoamend.org, you will find a sample amendment to the U.S. Constitution that will get money out of politics. Step one.
The smartest thing I've ever heard anyone say about anything.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Welcome back. Your media support group for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you, Joe, in Detroit area, listening on WDTW. I'm guessing, Joe. I don't see a city there. I'm sorry, on line six.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm in Bowling Green, Ohio.
Bowling Green, Ohio.
But we get
okay.
WDTW just barely.
Ah, okay. So what's up?
So, well, I'm a Green Party member in Ohio, and given right now the New York Times poll shows Obama up 10% in Ohio over Romney, some local polls are showing 11%, and given that the Greens, we need to get at least 1% for our candidate, Jill Stein, in order to maintain our party status,
right.
Would you say that that's a big enough margin, in Ohio anyway, for the people who have always wanted to vote Green to finally go ahead and vote Green this time around?
Well, I just hopped over to the Drudge Report because I thought that they had the numbers up there, but I don't see them at the top. But, you know, I'm hearing from the Foxosphere, you know, from the Fox so-called news area and whatnot, that Ohio actually, since the debate, has, you know, the president has fallen in Ohio. I don't frankly know what the numbers are, but I'll tell you, Ohio is a swing state. It is still a toss-up state. And
let me ask you, Tom, how big a margin do you want? Do you want 14%, 15%?
No, the polls may show 10%, but you've got a state.
I trust the New York Times poll more than most of the other ones. I trust the New York Times more than I trust Fox.
No, I don't disagree. And the polls may be absolutely accurate, but we've had a situation in the United States now for the last decade and a half or so where, you know, the polls might look really good, and particularly the exit polls might look really good, but, you know, after the voting's all done, and you discover, I mean, like in Ohio in 2004, you had 186,000 provisional ballots that were never opened or counted. That's 186,000 people who walked into the polls, and the polling person said, "You're not on my list, so I'm going to give you a ballot that you can vote on, but we're going to seal this, call it provisional, set it aside, and it's not going to get read unless somebody actually sues." And
well,
so
fraud is going to occur regardless.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that it has already happened. The Secretary of State of Ohio has been scrubbing the list like crazy. If you're going to have people at the polls challenging voters, you've got this million person funded by billionaires, you know, true the vote thing that's happening.
Yeah,
I would not take Ohio for granted. I would not take Ohio for granted.
Experience with John Husted. He took away votes that I got. I was running for U.S. Senate as a write-in candidate in the primaries, and I have people in at least four counties that documented, yes, I voted for you, who didn't show up on the roll. So they took votes away from us.
Yeah.
Also, there's people who are listed as Green Party members that when we've gone back and contacted them and said, you know, thanks for joining the party, their response is, what Green Party? I never joined the Green Party. What are you talking about? So I know that there's a lot of problems with voting in Ohio.
Yes, to say the very least.
So either we attack that problem directly, which, you know, John Kerry said he was going to do last time around. It didn't. Or, you know, but
well, he didn't become president.
From the question of how you're personally going to vote when you walk into the polls, because, yeah. I mean, do you want 20%? Is that a big enough margin?
I think in Ohio that, again, I don't trust the polls. I think in Ohio that if the president wins Ohio, it'll be by 1 or 2%. And, you know, we won't know until it's all over, but it might not even be by that. So I would be very, Ohio is one of the most important states because no Republican has ever won the White House without winning Ohio. And if Romney doesn't win Ohio, if he wins Ohio, he only has to win two other swing states. If he loses Ohio, he has to win six other swing states, if my recollection of the math is correct. It might be five, it might be seven, but it's something like that. He's got to win a bunch of them. And, his job gets much, much larger. So if I lived in Ohio, I would be voting Democratic. If I lived in Vermont, then, as I did when I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000, then it's a whole different thing. But Scott in Skowhegan, Maine. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good.
Hey, listen, I watched those debates the other night, and I voted for Obama. And what I've been seeing him for the last 3 years anyways is his backbone. He just don't have one.
I respectfully totally disagree with you. This is a guy who fought really, really hard for everything from the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act to 18 different tax cuts for working class people and small businesses to a national health care program that he took incredible stuff for and got that thing through that frankly, I think, particularly in 2016, when the state of Vermont and the state of Montana are able to roll out their single-payer health care programs as a result of Obamacare, is going to revolutionize health care in this country. I do not see that. What I see is a guy who has done the very, very best he can who's going up against a group of Republicans who, on the night that President Obama was inaugurated, sat together in the caucus room. Paul Ryan was one of them. John Kyle was one of them. Jim DeMint was one of them. Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich were there as advisors. This group of a little more than a dozen Republican members of the House, the leadership of the House of Representatives, Eric Cantor was there, leadership of the House of Representatives and the leaders from the Senate, sat together and basically swore a blood oath to each other. This is in Robert Draper's new book. Basically swore a blood oath to each other to obstruct the president in everything he did. And for 2 months at one day, the president had a 60-vote majority in the Senate and the Democrats held the House of Representatives. 2 months and one day out of the last 3.5 years. And in that 2 months and one day, a hell of a lot got done here in the United States. And then after that, when Scott Brown came into the United States Senate and the Democrats no longer held a majority in the Senate, and they could no longer, surmount the Republican filibusters that Mitch McConnell had said from day one. I mean, the day that Obama was inaugurated, Mitch McConnell declared that his goal, his number one job as leader of the Republicans of the Senate was to make Obama a one-term president. From day one, after that 2 months and one day, they successfully launched more filibusters, more obstruction than any Congress, any Senate in the history of the United States. I mean, this way exceeds Harry Truman's do-nothing Congress in 47-48. It's just, it's unprecedented. It's incredible. And this was an organized conspiracy to destroy the economy. Keep in mind, when these guys met at the Caucus Room restaurant down the street here from us, the night that these guys met, the night that Obama was sworn in, that month we lost 700,000 jobs. America was in free fall. And they swore to each other they were going to make things worse to hurt Obama.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So let me again point out the stakes in this election. The U.S. Supreme Court, which was supposed to be the third among equals, the weakest of all the branches of government, the one least likely to create mischief, as you can read in Federalist 78, 79, and 80, as I recall, Alexander Hamilton writing about the third branch, about the judiciary, and which has become the most powerful, arguably, of the three branches of government by asserting the power to strike down laws or even make laws, by asserting the power in 2000 to basically pick the president to overrule a state Supreme Court. Well, it goes beyond that. Scalia, which is the kind of justice we'll get with a Mitt Romney presidency. This is one of the ways that the Reagan presidency did so much damage to the United States, was the Supreme Court justices that Reagan put on the bench. Scalia, speaking at the American Enterprise Institute, talked about several topics. The death penalty. If you think the death penalty is barbaric, if you think that the death penalty, as you know, most developed countries in the world, I mean, you know, we have the death penalty, Iran has the death penalty, Saudi Arabia has the death penalty, Burma, North Korea, I mean, the number of countries that have the death penalty is actually fairly small these days. And if you think that the death penalty is barbaric, forget about it. This is Scalia said, the death penalty, give me a break, it's easy. In other words, of course, you know, of course. This, by the way, just the day after the 18th man has been freed from death row with DNA evidence, found that he had nothing to do with the crime. We have no idea how many people we've put to death who were innocent. We know that Rick Perry has put to death at least one, and that George W. Bush probably put to death several. But, you know, we don't know, because nobody's looking into cold, dead cases, right? So anyhow, Scalia, death penalty, easy. Abortion, absolutely easy. Nobody ever thought the Constitution prevented restrictions on abortions. In other words, the Constitution says, you know, it's just fine for Congress to decide that they're going to regulate abortions, if that's an issue for you. Homosexual sodomy, come on. I'm quoting Scalia now. Come on, he says, for 200 years it was criminal in every state. Now, this is, in other words, he's saying it's just fine to have gay sex be a crime. A crime. He says, and he went on to say, the Constitution means exactly what I think it ought to mean. Verbatim quote. So I would, you know, respectfully submit to you that this election is a BFD. It's a big deal. And it's one that we need to attend to, and we need to be doing something about, and we need to be showing up. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Ray, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. You did a rant back at the end of a show about efforts to privatize public education. I've been trying to call you ever since. My wife and I are retired public school teachers in Illinois looking to relocate and teach in Colorado. And we noticed that public schools in Colorado pay $40,000 to start and charter 26. And my first thought was, if vouchers are funding charters, where's the other $14,000 go?
It's going to the CEOs and the stockholders.
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot of openings out there for charters, so I suspect the public schools are getting the first choice of the best candidates. Plus, we always hear about vouchers helping poor kids have a better choice, and that sounds wonderful, but I've always suspected there are a lot of people just wanted to recoup their tax dollars because they resent paying taxes for other people's kids' educations and then tuition further on. I wonder if anybody's ever thought this through. If a well-off family paid $10,000 in real estate taxes and had four kids in school, and a voucher was worth $10,000, taxpayers could end up subsidizing their kids' private education to the tune of $30,000 a year more than they paid in taxes.
Right. Although, you know, that argument is one that I'm not fond of, because that, you know, I from time to time I'll get somebody calling in the program going, I never got married, I'm single, and I have to pay property taxes, and out of that, there's money going to the schools, and damn it, I don't have any kids, why am I having to pay for this? And my answer, of course, is because you live in this society. Right. You know, we all benefit from public education, from having an educated workforce and an educated populace. And you know, some people are going to be, you know, paying a little more in tax, some a little less. It's not, you know, obviously, it's not going to be the people who have the kids are the ones who are paying for their kids' education. If
you always say, it's the price of admission.
Yeah, exactly. Paraphrasing, who was it? Oliver Wendell Holmes. Thank you, Shannon. Yeah, the price
thanks
of admission.
That's all I had to say. Thanks.
You said it very well, Ray. Thanks a lot for the call. Ken in Joliet. Hey, Ken, what's up? Ken?
Yeah.
Hey, you're on the air.
I'm glad you took my call. I married a Mexican, and you know, 1978, you know, we had three kids. Thanks to Prop 187, you know, Mexico changed its nationality law, so not only is my wife's now a dual citizen, my children are citizens of both of the countries, and even my three-year-old daughter is a citizen.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. What they did after Mexico got so pissed off with Prop, remember Prop 187? That was the one that said if, you know, American-born children of illegal parents couldn't go to school in California.
Right.
Yes, well, Mexico, Supreme Court threw that bit out because, you know, 14th Amendment, you know, but...
So Mexico's rebuttal to that was to say we're going to allow people of Mexican heritage who are living in the United States or Mexican ancestry to be dual citizens if they want.
Right, right.
Which, by the way, a lot of countries do. Israel does, Norway does. I mean, there's a bunch
of... Yeah. It used to be if you... you know, up until the 1924 Immigration Act, if a American man married a foreign woman, mm-hmm. she immediately became a citizen. And if an American woman married a foreign man, she immediately lost her citizenship.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's the way it was. But yeah. Do you think that...
So your question or your point?
We might have a backlash... against all this voter suppression stuff. I mean, not immediately, of course, but by the next election.
I think there's a backlash already going on. I think one of the reasons why the Republicans are doing so poorly in the Hispanic and African-American communities is not just the inherent racism that the Republican Party has embraced since Nixon's Southern Strategy in the 70s. I think it's because the... You know, it's been put on steroids by the American Legislative Exchange Council and all these laws that ALEC has been promoting that make it harder for people to vote, particularly people who are not particularly wealthy, but people who don't own enough money, don't have enough money to own a car, and therefore, you know, don't have a driver's license. I think the backlash is well underway, and
you know,
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you.
No, I finished my point.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, you know, I mean, there were never any miscegenation laws in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Mexicans that have come up here have no qualms against marrying white or black people. So,
sure.
You know, I think that's one of the reasons they're...
Were Hispanics included in the miscegenation laws in the United States up until the 1960s?
No, actually they weren't. It was bizarre.
Yeah.
Because they were white by treaty.
By treaty? Is this after the Mexican-American War?
Yeah.
During the Polk administration? Fascinating. Ken, I learn something every day doing this show. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the information. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday, by the way. Another 15 minutes or so, Attorney General of the State of New York, Eric Schneiderman, is going to drop by. The guy who just went after J.P. Morgan Chase. The guy who may take down the banks. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And today we're going to be giving away a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild America. An autographed copy. A book by me. Find the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I had a, I was going to say breakfast, but we didn't eat, actually. We sat in the lobby of the hotel down the street and around the corner from here this morning with David Friend, the guy who started Carbonite. And he started originally years ago because he was concerned about his daughter's computer constantly crashing. And so anyhow, he's a sponsor of the show. One of our advertisers, which is why we were getting together. And I am not telling this story as a way of plugging Carbonite. I'm telling this story because I thought it was just a really cool story. He said that they used to have their customer service, their tech support. You know, if you call the 800 number and say, I got a problem with my program here. What do I do? So they used to have it in India. And, you know, a year and a half or so ago, he said, this is just wrong. You know, we should set it up in the United States, even if it costs, even if we go broke, even if it costs us money, even if it cuts badly into our profits, we should be doing this in the United States. And so they set up a call center in Maine, and they have some 200 and some odd employees there now. And he said what's incredible about it, and this is the Carry Home story. I want you to share this with anybody you can who, you know, in any company that you contact who has offshored their pink collar, white collar force. He said they're actually, number one, the customer satisfaction has gone from being in the 20% range, customer satisfaction with their tech support, from the 20% range to the high 90s. And number two, they're actually saving money. He said in India they had 100% turnover a year on the employees. He said the employee will literally go to a call center across the street for an extra 5 cents a day. And in the United States, you get good employees who really want to work and who are really smart, and they're you know, just, it's working very, very well for them. It's actually been a profitable thing for Carbonite and better customer service. So, you know, I think more and more companies need to be doing that. I just thought it was a cool story. Anyhow, Layden in Avon Park, Florida, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm really concerned that I know that the presidential election is very important, but we're watching the front of the chicken coop and the foxes are coming in the back. And the reason I say this is here in Florida, we have 11 amendments to change the Constitution, and I just want to make two quick points. Like one of them is that nobody can force you to take health care. Another one is no funding for abortion, examples like that. And the second point is there are a bunch of them that are for tax, real estate tax exemptions, mm-hmm. and it sounds really good, like if a person has lost their significant other in a war or a firefighter, then they get exempted from real estate taxes. Right. And who would say no to that? But if you think about it, with all these tax exemptions, we have no state income tax. And when they start giving all these real estate property taxes, the counties are going to go belly up and everything's going to get privatized.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Layden, thank you very much. Excellent point. Jason in D.C. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Hey, I just want to talk about the fact that the new NDAA legislation that's being proposed right now is going to make it so that the U.S. government can now use propaganda legally on U.S. citizens.
Oh, my.
There's an article in the Business Insider about this. And essentially what happened was it's going to negate the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948, which after the war, the U.S., you know, was kind of, people, a lot of people here were worried about, you know, propaganda and stuff and what had gone on with the Nazis, and they didn't want the government using it on ourselves.
Right.
So,
well, there was,
you know,
also a fair number of people in 48 who still remembered 1918, and the word was out by that point in time that Woodrow Wilson had hired Edward Bernays to literally create the industry of public relations in order to sell World War I to the American people, which is a war that, you know, nobody can still to this day figure out why it started, who was fighting for what, and why the United States got involved.
Right. All the wars, again, started by false flag incidences.
Yeah, it seems.
You know.
So, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, I'm not sure it was a false flag, but it was a phony baloney reason to have a war. It was a sign of, you know, interlocking treaties and their danger. But your point about the new NDAA, I'll have to track that down. Thanks a lot for the heads up on that, Jason. Jeff in Grants Pass, Oregon. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I was trying to call when Bernie was on because I think he's probably the most representative in Washington. But your caller called about the Green Party.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I see the need in this country for some other parties to break up this power structure. In 1980, I voted for George Anderson. I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I voted for George Anderson. And I regretted that decision.
It wasn't
for
George.
12 years.
It was, what was Anderson's first name? Now you've scared it out of me, and Shane scratched his head.
15%.
Yeah, it was John Anderson, wasn't it? Yeah, John Anderson.
John Anderson, sorry, but he got about 15%.
I don't think he got that much. I don't think John Anderson.
You know, it was a pretty significant chunk. You can look it up.
He did get a good chunk. I recall that.
Yeah, Reagan. You know, Reagan, everybody talks about what a landslide Reagan won him, but he only had 40-some-odd% of the vote.
Yeah, and that's the problem. That's one of the third-party problems. Jeff.
And, just like Nader. You know, I mean, I love Ralph Nader. I think he would have been a better president than either one of the guys that, were running. But he gave the White House to the Republicans.
Well, you could argue that. I mean, he say again. He got okay. John Anderson got 7%. Just for the record, Ralph Nader got 97,000 votes in Florida in the 2000 election, if my memory serves me correctly, and I'm pretty sure it does. And there are people who say, you know, hey, had Ralph Nader not been on the ticket, Al Gore would, you know, George W. Bush would not have been able to steal the election down there. The Supreme Court wouldn't have been able to steal the election. But the fact of the matter is that Kathleen Harris and Jeb Bush had knocked between 60 and 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls just in the months leading up to the 2000 election. And frankly, if Ralph Nader hadn't been on the ballot, I think they probably would have knocked 160,000 off. I mean, they knew what they needed to do. So what we need to be doing is not saying, oh, we shouldn't have third parties, although, you know, we need to have that conversation. How do we diversify politics? But
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But instead of that, what we need to be doing is pushing back against voter suppression efforts, calling this stuff out. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, and happy to have you with us, and very happy to have the Attorney General for the State of New York, Eric Schneiderman, on the line with us. Attorney General Schneiderman, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. And you are also, I should say, the chairperson of the President Obama's Mortgage Fraud Task Force, and you've been working with Beau Biden, who was on this program a couple of days ago. Looking into what's going on with the banksters here, you just went after J.P. Morgan Chase. How did you get started tracking, you know, going down this road that led to this J.P. Morgan Chase? Is indictment the correct word?
No, it's a complaint.
Thank
it's
you.
It's a 31-page complaint seeking that they give back everything that they took in through fraud. The way I got started was really pretty simple. When I got elected beginning of last year, took office, and at that time there was a negotiation going on between a lot of my fellow AGs and some agencies in the federal government to try and resolve issues related to abuses in the foreclosure process, really focus more on robo-signing and things like that than on the underlying securities fraud that brought down the American economy. The banks were seeking very broad releases. They really wanted to be let off the hook for their conduct in 2004, 5, 6, and 7 that created the bubble and the crash that we're still trying to recover from. I took a very hard line that we were not going to let them off the hook. I was not going to sign on to those releases. Beau Biden was another AG who stood with me in that position. And late last year, the White House and my federal counterparts came around and said, okay, let's narrow the releases. Let's have a joint investigation. And in the State of the Union address, the president announced the creation of our working group. So I'm a co-chair of that, along with colleagues from the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and U.S. Attorney John Walsh from Colorado. It has been an incredible, unprecedented state-federal collaboration that's enabled us to bring this complaint. More complaints are to follow, but this is what's called a platform case. This is not about one deal or two deals or 10 deals. This alleges that J.P. Morgan Chase's as successor to Bear Stearns and EMC Mortgage, companies that they now own, is responsible for a pattern of really pretty flagrant fraud, probably the only way I can describe it. The entire process of their issuing of mortgage-backed securities in the time when the worst of the worst loans were being given out and the worst of the worst securities were being sold to investors, 2005 to 2007, was based on fraud. They Bear Stearns was the number one issuer of mortgage-backed securities back then. They issued $113 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities in 2006, and all the investors who bought them were assured multiple times that they were checking the loans, that they had a good system of what's called due diligence to make sure that all of the lenders they bought from in bulk were following appropriate guidelines, that they were checking for the borrower's ability to pay, that they were examining the loans, if third-party firms running checks, and that even after they deposited all these mortgages into the mortgage-backed securities and sold them, they continued to monitor. These are all promises that were made to the investors, and no one, in our view, was going to buy a mortgage-backed security from a firm that didn't say they were at least checking to make sure the paperwork was right, the loans were good. It was all a sham. We had internal communications showing that they were not doing anything like the due diligence process they promised. They referred to it in their promotional materials as robust and intensive. Inside, they acknowledged to each other how bad things were.
Right.
We have evidence from a third-party firm that they hired a specialist in this area, that they hired to examine loans. And we have evidence from the third-party firm that they kept identifying bad loans, and the folks at Bear Stearns would wave them in, would say, we don't care about the problems. They put a lot of them in their securities anyway. And they identified their, in one particularly telling comment, they identified the lenders as their, quote, number one client. So they were more worried about their relationship with folks like Countrywide and American Home Mortgage, who were giving out bad loans, because they were afraid of, if they rejected too many of the loans, that they wouldn't be getting any more from these lenders.
Those
and they
people
needed
just
the
go
loans
to the bank.
To keep making money on the securities. So this is the pattern of fraud that we've been investigating with the help of our colleagues in government. The SEC has been terrific about sharing their knowledge and experience and information. Folks at the Department of Justice, we had U.S. attorney's offices all over the country helping us doing interviews and things. So this is the president, when he announced this, really made it clear that we were going to dig in and once and for all do something about the fraud that brought down the economy. And I can say this working group is working, Tom. We brought this case, and there are more to come.
It is spectacular, the work that you're doing, Attorney General Schneiderman. We're talking with the Attorney General for the state of New York, Eric Schneiderman, whose purview, of course, includes the New York banks, which are located in New York. My understanding of the history of what allowed these banksters to do this kind of stuff has always been that in 99 and 2000, Phil Graham's wife, Wendy, was on the board of Enron. Ken Lay wanted to be able to trade oil futures and other kinds of options as securities in unregulated markets. So we got Graham, Leach, Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that allowed Enron to be more like a bank, you know, blew up the line between commercial banks and investment banks, and that also, moved or created a whole new area of securities that didn't have to be traded on regulated exchanges. Is that an accurate understanding of part of the genesis of this problem, or is something else at the root or the core or the cause of this problem?
Well, I think there are two problems, and we have to be very clear about that. And the first is what you're referring to, which is this era of really irresponsible deregulation.
Right.
And it took place across the board. It wasn't really just in the context of banking, but we do know that, as you mentioned, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act came out codifying the idea that they weren't going to regulate derivatives, but there were other things that happened. The actual amount of money that banks were required by the federal banking regulators to set aside to back up their mortgage-backed securities was reduced early in the last decade. In 2004, in a particularly horrendous piece of public policy, the federal government declined to regulate subprime loans and then went on to preempt states we're trying to regulate subprime.
Yeah, that was the Bush administration. Actually, didn't they executive order go to court or something to stop the states from trying to regulate those?
Yeah,
things?
No, this was a big controversy. But in addition to the reckless deregulation, and that's something that it's tremendously important that we get a little more public attention and a little more activist attention on the rulemaking process that's going on in Washington now, where the whole point of the Dodd-Frank rulemaking is to solve that problem, to put into place a good system of regulations to ensure this never happens again. But in addition to the bad deregulation that made some things legal that shouldn't have been legal, that wasn't even enough for some of these folks. In addition to that, we never passed a law saying it's okay to commit fraud. We never passed a law to say you can promise your investors over and over again that your securities are being checked carefully and that you're examining all the loans, very detailed representations in prospectuses and all sorts of offering materials, and have that not be true. You're not allowed to trick people into buying securities stuffed with bad loans by assuring them that you have this high quality due diligence process,
right.
And, you know, risk scoring, and that you're checking this out. In fact, as early as the beginning of 2005, the defendants were reducing the amount of due diligence conducted, and as one of them said, in order to make us more competitive on bids with larger subprime sellers.
So these guys were breaking the law to make more profit. How did they think they'd get away with it?
It's one of those things that you see as a pattern. I've been in this business for a while. I was spent 15 years in private practice. I actually represented some big financial services firms. I know a lot of folks in the business. Sometimes you see other folks doing it, and things look too good to leave alone, and you just lose your sense of things. But what is clear from the internal documents we've gotten, and we subpoenaed J.P. Morgan Chase. My office subpoenaed them last June. We've been working on this investigation since last spring. We've seen from the internal documents that there was just this relentless pressure to get more loans, produce more securities. Time pressure, the folks who were supposed to be reviewing them sacrificed quality for quantity starting in 2005, through 2006, into 2007. And we know that's when really the most toxic securities were sold. They were bought by investors who were well-to-do, but they were also bought by pension funds, by mutual funds. A lot of folks lost their retirement savings. And when the bubble crashed, because this is what was driving up housing prices, the fact that they gave lines of credit to these unscrupulous lenders, the lenders were out there giving folks who should not have been buying a house loans. I mean, they were out, the number of loans that were either negative amortization or interest-only loans. That's to say, you're not really paying off your loan. In fact, with negative amortization loans, you owe more each month. It went from a tiny portion of the market to close to 30% of the market over this period of time.
Attorney General Schneiderman, I'm sorry we're flat out of time here, but it is... Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The machine steps on me, sir. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right, thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you.
I see trees of green, red, I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the companies that syndicate, the various syndicators of our program, Dial Global on commercial radio, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial radio, Free Speech TV, carrying us on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the folks at RTTV and Free Speech TV, to Sue Nethercutt, our newsletter editor, the folks in our chat room. Hey, how are you? To Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It's much appreciated. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Ronnie in Chicago. Hey, Ronnie, what's on your mind?
Thank you very much, Tom. I love your show. It's a great show. I listen to you every day.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make an observation about Senator Sanders. I know that he can't say it, but I will. The Republicans are fascist. I mean, we're dealing with fascism.
Yeah, it's the merger of corporate and state interests. And the ultimate example of that would be a guy who is still making $20 million a year, you know, just sitting on his butt doing nothing, or campaigning for president, as the case may be, from his ownership in a company that owns a bunch of other companies, including many of them offshore and overseas and whatnot, running for president. It's I don't disagree with your use of the word fascist. I know a lot of people are very afraid of it, but I think it's if you look at the history of the word, it's accurate. Chris in Carrollton, Texas. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Fine. What's on your mind, Chris?
Well, I was going to make a couple observations or state a couple observations.
Pick one,
and then
please.
I have a couple questions that'll go real quick.
Pick one.
In the debate, Mitt Romney said, you know, in the middle of calling the president a liar, he said that he didn't have the right to his own facts. And I was wondering, because like I've noticed over the past 4 years, the Republicans all along have kind of come up with stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and I never knew where it came from. But like a couple of weeks back, I saw Christy O'Donnell on a show, and she said that with every job created under Obama, 4 have been lost.
Right.
And I was like, where is she getting that fact?
Yeah, she's just pulling it out of her ear. And this is, and you know, what Mitt Romney was doing with that and with his statement about how his boys lie and much like the guy on the other side of the stage from him, what he was trying to do was neutralize any attacks against him for lying or for making up his own facts. And, you know, paraphrasing Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you know, you can be entitled to your opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Yeah, good point. Ginger in Berniston, Massachusetts. Hey, Ginger, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Glad to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm just an independent voter in Massachusetts who unfortunately voted for Romney for governor when he wasn't even a resident in our state.
Yeah, he was apparently a resident of Utah.
I just wanted to say that I was one of the foolish. And during his tenure, he put through Romney Care, which is working quite well. Unfortunately, I don't want to give him credit. He did increase a lot of fees and taxes through his 4 years in office. And I just think that it's ironic that he should get up there on stage and blatantly accuse our president of not doing his job. He's a stuffed blue shirt, starched to the neck, and I think he's just got us buffaloed.
Yeah, well, he's got a lot of people buffaloed. Ginger, apparently he doesn't have you buffaloed. That's good. Thank you for the call. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
Yes, I watched the presidential debate Wednesday, and in a lump sum, I was wondering what in the world was talked about, because, you know, on a common everyday language or level for people with an eighth-grade education, if the president could present his views and facts on an eighth-grade level,
yeah,
more people would understand what's going on. And I feel like we Democrats need to push our contract with America like Newt Gingrich did, and maybe we will stand out better. And, you know, liberal's not a cuss word, is it? You know?
No, it's not. And you're right. We do need to simplify things. And one of the president's, I don't think it's a shortcoming. I think it's actually one of his great strengths is that he was a law professor. He could be professorial. He's a deep thinker. He understands topics and he uses polysyllabic words, you know, he uses big words. And he did so in the debate, you know, which, you know, I guess is supposed to be a cardinal sin. I think it was in general a good thing. Alan in Sylvania, Ohio. We have a minute to the end of the show. Alan, it's yours.
Hi, Tom. Listen to your show all the time on the way home from work on the radio here in Sirius.
Mm-hmm.
Point I wanted to make, and I was kind of hoping we'd hear more about it on the campaign here, is Obama just touched on Social Security, said him and Romney have about the same thoughts on it. Well, I think we ought to start expounding on the fact that, you know, if they want to privatize it, I guess I have to ask you, what does that mean? Does it mean that we'll save as much as we can?
Well, neither one of them are on record being in favor of privatizing Social Security. I think that President Obama made a huge mistake when he said, I agree with President or Governor Romney on Social Security. First of all, nobody knows what Romney has to say about Social Security or anything else, because if you wait 6 months, it'll be a different position. You know, whichever way the winds are blowing. Secondly, his running mate, Paul Ryan, is on the record as wanting to privatize Social Security. So I think that was a dangerous thing. But neither one of them are on the record saying that they want to privatize Social Security right now, which is what the president, I think, was trying to say. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman program, it's Columbus Day. I'll be telling you the real story behind this holiday. You might want to skip the celebrations. Plus, we'll have the latest news from the campaign trail, as well as the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're in. Occupy something. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.